You're driving down a street and see a red light. Without a thought, your foot lifts from the accelerator and hits the brake. You're in a rehearsal, and your fingers dance along the keys on their own. You are immersed in a novel with no effort to remember individual words. These actions are possible by neurons in our brains that communicate at lightning speed. Their signals travel routes formed through learning, experience, and memory. And sometimes the pathways and signals don't work as they should. How can we possibly map the journeys of such complex, vital conversations inside our brains? I'm Jerry Broughton. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this podcast, we hear from those who live and love maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the stories that lie behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it, go to oculi-mundi.com. How are experiences like, say, learning to walk or piloting a plane physically encoded onto our brains? Professor Jeff Lichtman has dedicated most of his professional life to figuring this out. Professor Lichtman is a neuroscientist, the Jeremy R. Knowles Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology, and the first Santiago Ramon y Cajal Professor of Arts and Sciences, both at Harvard University. He's well known for developing the BrainBow technique, a pioneering imaging process which allows individual neurons in the brain to be distinguished from each other. In 2024, he and colleagues at the Lichtman Lab collaborated with Google Research to produce the most detailed map of a human brain sample ever created. This momentous breakthrough was named in the New York Times 2024 Good Tech Awards. Jeff, welcome to What's Your Map?
Thank you very much.
Can we start by you explaining this beautifully coloured map to me, which is extraordinary? I mean, it's showing us an insight into the brain, but at the same time, it looks like the most beautiful abstract expressionist painting from the 1950s or 60s that I've ever seen as well. So what are we looking at? Take me through it, Jeff.
What we're seeing in the map that I sent you is a fragment, truly a very small fragment of a human brain of a living person who was undergoing neurosurgery, and this piece of brain was removed to get access to a deeper part of the brain where the neurosurgeons were trying to correct a problem. Actually, epilepsy was the problem in that person. And to get rid of the epilepsy, they had to remove a little bit of the hippocampus where the epilepsy had started. And we took this chunk of brain, which only is about a cubic millimeter, so not much bigger than the head of a pin, and we sliced it into very, very thin sections that each are about a thousandth as thick as a human hair. And then we took pictures of each of those sections with a very fancy kind of electron microscope that images very quickly, called a multi-beam scanning electron microscope. And then from those pictures, we aligned all those pictures, and then with the help of Google, got a wiring diagram of each of the cells in there and what each of those cells, which are nerve cells called neurons, is doing. That is, who is it talking to? Each cell talks to a bunch of other neurons, and each neuron also receives information from a bunch of other neurons. And what's shown here are the neurons that are in this particular piece of brain, and the color represents the size of the cells.
I'm so fascinated by this in terms of the coloring and then the distinctions between the neuron, the axon, and the dendrites, and what's happening when we look.
Neurons have three general components: a cell body, and out of the cell body emerges an axon, which is a process that sends information to other cells. At the ends of the branches of the axon are things called synapses, where the axon releases chemicals onto the dendrites of other neurons. So in addition to an axon, every neuron also has dendrites. And these dendrites are where they receive synaptic connections from the axons of other cells. And every cell has one axon that makes those connections on other cells. So you have this chain of information flow, very much like a Twitter feed. You're following a lot of people who are telling you things, and you have a bunch of followers that you tell to. So your axon is like who you're talking to, how you talk to others, and your dendrites are where all the inputs are coming in. They're like your ears and your eyes as you're reading your Twitter feed. So when you first look at a map of the brain and you don't colorize it in any particular way, you just maybe put random colors in, it looks like a Jackson Pollock drawing, a true form of abstract painting, as you referred to, but there's no rhyme or reason. But if you start coloring cells by their size, and in this picture you see a lot of little colored circles and then all the wires around them, those colored circles are the cell bodies of neurons, and you see that at the top, all the cells are very small because the colors are coded from tiny being blue to the giant cells being red, and every color in between. And you see that now, rather than a Jackson Pollock picture, you have a whole band of cells. We call this a cortical layer at the top that has very small cells. And then below it, the orange-looking cells in layers 2 and 3 are bigger. And then as we go down a little farther, you see a little small blue layer again. That's layer 4. That's the input layer of many parts of the cortex where a lot of information from other parts of the brain are coming. And then below that is layer 5 with the biggest cells of all, the big red cells at the bottom there. Those big cells are the layer 5 cells. And then below that are layer 6 cells. And below that, but not shown here, is the white matter, which is where the cables of the axons that are coming from this part of the brain send their information to other parts of the brain. There is a lot of method to the madness, I would say, of this crazy wiring diagram, in the sense that it's not entirely crazy. It's very well organized. And this is a part of the brain that is responsible for storing memories. But even here, even though everybody's memories are different, there are certain rules to the way the brain is organized in terms of what kinds of cells and who is talking to who in the various layers.
I've seen some of your talks, and one of the things that you talk about, and just thinking about how the brain works and learns things, and then you see this enacted in the map, you have a great example about riding a bike. I didn't learn to ride a bike until I was 50 years old.
And how did that go for you?
It was embarrassing, because I asked a guy at a bike shop to, I said, I've got kids and I need to learn to ride a bike. And I didn't as a kid. And he thought this was very funny. And we wobbled around and I just couldn't do it. It was just the most embarrassing and also quite funny thing. But then I did. So I'm interested in what you'll say about this in terms of what's happening with this map. So what then happens, Jeff? What are the neurons and the axons and the dendrites doing that enables me now, as I do, I bike around New York quite happily. I can do it. What's happened there, and how is this map showing us what's happening?
Well, the traditional idea about how brain cells are activated requires a slight revision, I think, to understand what actually is going on. If you look at the other picture I provided you with, the picture of one of these neurons.
Looks like a beautiful tree.
Right. It's a tree, and all you're seeing there are its dendrites, and then there's all these little hairs all over the place.
Yeah.
All those hairs are axons of other neurons that are talking to that particular cell. So that cell is being pinged or tweeted to or X'd or whatever you want to call it by thousands, literally thousands of different axons that are talking to it, each of which are just talking in a whisper because they are making one synaptic connection on one dendrite. And the normal textbook explanation of how this cell is activated is that a bunch of those axons must simultaneously work to release neurotransmitters, chemical neurotransmitters at those synapses that they make to activate the target cell strongly enough that the target cell pays attention and then sends that information on to the next cell in a chain, a cascade of cells. with reading and with riding a bicycle, I cannot teach you this by writing a book. If I wrote a book that explained to you how to ride a bicycle, let's say it was 800 pages long, and I say, study this book, memorize everything in there, and then I give you a bicycle, you will not be able to ride that bicycle from the knowledge in that book. There's only one way to learn to ride a bicycle, and that is to ride a bicycle and to fall off and to get all of the necessary parts of doing that, which is enormously complicated, to go from being difficult and cognitive to being basically a reflex. So somehow humans have to turn what they could not possibly have learned from their evolution into something that they learned through their experience, that you didn't inherit the ability to ride a bike. You had to learn it for yourself. We come into the world not being able to do anything well, but we end up being expert at a subset of the things that we've been exposed to, and we become quite good at those things, probably by making very powerful connections and a map that basically now has highways rather than just little small roads. There are certain highways that get you from one place to another very, very quickly. Once you have these very powerful connections, you have a very fast path by skipping all the requirement of the cognitively strong effort that it took when you were first learning. Now everything is automatic and you're not thinking about it anymore. It's very much like a reflex in any other animal that comes through genetics. In humans, it comes through learning. The disturbing part is you give a child a bicycle, they're going to pick it up in a remarkably short amount of time. You give a 50-year-old a bicycle, it's like, you know, like you're just uncoordinated. You can't do it. And so there's something about young brains' wiring diagrams that make them more plastic or able to record information than older brains. And this is a very disturbing thing as we get older. And I'm substantially older than you, but the feeling that learning is something I'm not still doing with the same skill and ease that I was doing as a child is painful to me.
Tell me a little bit about Brainbow, because it's one of the things I understand that has produced and gives us those incredibly beautifully colored maps. What is this as a process?
The idea of Brainbow was to take advantage of the discovery that led to the beginning of neurobiology, which was by Ramón y Cajal, who was a Spanish neuroanatomist who was using a stain called the Golgi stain from Camille Golgi, an Italian scientist, and they shared a Nobel Prize for this work. They didn't like each other at all, I might add, so they never really talked much. But that was a stain that stained very small numbers of cells in their entirety in the brain. So you might stain 1% of the brain cells with no particular, it's kind of random which cells stained. What we thought is, if instead of using this blackish brown stain, if we could make a colored stain, like Golgi stain, but colored, and we could have many different colors, then you could have all the cells labeled just like with the Golgi stain, but now in different colors. And that's what we did with the help of molecular biologists who knew a lot more molecular biology than me, especially my colleague Josh Sains. And the lead author was also a very sophisticated molecular biologist, Sean Levay. And ultimately, it was really about 80 different colors, but that was enough to see this enormously beautiful map of all these cells. We still use it. We're publishing a paper soon on a place in the brain where things are big, where Brainbow is absolutely the tool of choice. But when it comes to getting all the wires in the cortex, the cerebral cortex, which has all these fine wires, we had to go to serial section electron microscopy and had to develop a whole bunch of new tools for that.
What does the map allow you to do, Jeff, that perhaps other forms of data collection don't? Because it's a graphic representation of something spatial, isn't it? But this is at such an infinitesimally tiny level. What is it about the map? What does it do for you?
The reason you need a map in the brain, it may not be immediately obvious until you start thinking about how you use the brain for behavior. Behavior basically is sensory information comes in, it rattles around the brain, and then out goes a motor output. I'll give you an example of a behavior. If you know how to drive a car, you see a red light, the red color in those circular form impinges on the retina, and that signal then passes through one neuron after another through a very complicated relay of neurons that are separated just by synapses. That's how one neuron talks to another. And finally sends signals all the way down your spinal cord to the muscles in your leg to lift your leg off the gas pedal and put it on the brake pedal. There's a map of connectivity starting from the retina and getting you to your foot muscles. And you have to connect all that. And if it went in any other direction, you'd crash through the intersection and you wouldn't be alive. So there's survival value in learning, in getting that map right. So all of these maps, in human brains at least, are being generated through experience. And that makes them extremely interesting because we're encoding information that's coming in our lifetimes. These maps are showing us, although we can't read them very well, all the memories that we have.
Hi, listeners. We're learning so much about how complex the brain is, or building new wiring diagrams, as Jeff might put it. Speaking of learning and memories, I'd love to encourage you to subscribe to this podcast and spread the word. You can hear from other amazing guests, like a NASA scientist defending the Earth or a marine biologist teaching us about ocean currents. And you can visit oculi-mundi.com to see the maps they are talking about. Subscribing means you won't miss a single map, guest or story from this series, or the next. Now back to Jeff and mapping the brain. I do think looking at your work, it is fascinating that that is really what's going on. The map is a form of connectivity that you just described, which presumably is unique. And in those surprising discoveries, does that mean that you're reaching for new understandings of specifically how the human brain works in contrast to other kinds of animal brains?
Yeah, I think one of the great ironies about being a human being is that relative to even other mammals that can learn things, if you have a dog, you can teach them a trick like sit, they will sit, where they certainly didn't know that genetically. In fact, if you say that in German to a German dog, or you say that in Mandarin to a dog in China, they will sit based on whichever language they hear, which is always fascinating when you think that dog knows Chinese or knows German. But humans are different in the sense that we know much less about the world when we come into the world. And so we are absolutely dependent. We're obligate learners. Learning is not just an other part of our survival. We are the only animal, I think, that actually must learn in order to survive. And because we've shed so much of our kind of reflexive behaviors, we are very susceptible to not surviving without a lot of care. And we take it for granted that it takes a year or so to learn how to walk. That is an extraordinarily long time for any other animal to learn how to be able to be mobile. And then we don't give, driver's licenses for another 15 years. You have to be 16, and we don't leave the nest in many cultures until you go to college, which is another 4 years later. And, you don't get tenure until you're 50 or something.
Ridiculous. Tell us about it. Yeah. Mm.
It's just really, really painful how slow it is. However, whereas most other animals are basically set for life, after just a few weeks or a month of life, they are mature. Humans continue to be learning machines throughout their lives, albeit, I would say, not as efficiently as we are as children. And one of the differences between the map of a baby, and I know this from animal work, not human work, is that the maps are much, you might think they, but if you don't know anything, the maps must be much simpler, but they're not. They're much more complicated. Cells are much more interconnected at the beginning. And a lot of this map making is trimming away and throwing away parts of the map that are of no use based on the experiences that particular animal, and I suspect human, have had. And in a way, education and I'm a professor, so I'm quite sensitive to this, is destructive. We're trying to prune away all but what we believe are the right things that you should know about the world. And, you know, once people believe something, it's very hard to get them to change their minds. And I think one of the reasons may be because those connections no longer exist.
That's fascinating. Because, and again, that's what Google does. The way in which they allow you to zoom in and out so quickly is to do just what you've described, so that they shed the data that's irrelevant to you.
That's right.
And how is that related to this issue of connectomics? I love the idea of this term because, again, it's such a mapping issue that you're connecting data in this way.
In the Brainbow paper that we published in Nature, we said that this Technicolor Golgi is basically a way of having a connectomic map of the brain. And we put it in quotes because we were just kidding.
That's a great term.
I'm really serious about that. But it did catch on, and it's now in the Oxford English Dictionary. You know, it's now really a term that is used. So, I like the term, although old people, even older than me, say, this is really just neuroanatomy. Yeah. You know, just admit it. It's just neuroanatomy. It is neuroanatomy, but it's at a level that's designed to see wiring diagrams and to map the brain. And some people thought this is neurocartography.
What are those connectomics helping us understand, maybe, Jeff? Is it helping us in terms of thinking about mental disorders or the way in which the brain degenerates or how it develops? What are those connections allowing you to see?
I think the basic science question has often been, what is the physical structure of the brain that explains behavior? The first idea being that the structure of the brain gives rise to function. The second is that the function of using the brain gives rise to the structure. And that's the work I've told you a little bit about, sort of learning, how learning is instantiated in the brain. Then the third general area is, what about when brains are not working the way they normally do? And we can think about normal situations like this, like in children, as opposed to adults. Babies are, they just don't have brains that work the way ours do. And very old human beings and old animals have brains that don't work the way younger brains work. And sometimes it's because of a neurodegenerative disease in old age. But even without that, I don't think anyone, even a person who has not got a neurodegenerative disease, the way they use their brain is much more automatically than someone who has to think through things at a younger age. And then, of course, maybe the most important area where connectomics might be able to make a difference is for the large number of diseases of cognition where we know something is not normal or not typically working the way most people's brains work, but we do not know what the underlying cause. Because for most diseases, pathology turns out to be a critical part of the insight process that ultimately leads to a cure. You first figure out what's wrong, and then you figure out how to cure it. With these diseases of cognition, we know from the outside what's wrong, but we don't know what's wrong with the brain. Whereas if you have a liver disease or a kidney disease or a heart disease or a lung disease, we have all sorts of invasive and non-invasive imaging approaches to show what is wrong with the tissue, make the diagnosis. And because we know what's wrong, we often know what we need to do to fix it. In the case of these diseases of the brain, we do not know, and maybe connectomics is a form of high-resolution neuropathology that will give us some insights.
And how far have we traveled in that, or perhaps maybe you in terms of your career? Because I'm interested in where you sit within all this. How far has that understanding about the brain developed within the period in which you've been doing this kind of work? And I guess some idea similarly of the data, because, you know, some of these data sets could have been analyzed over 50 years and you've suddenly shrunk that so quickly with the tech. Just could you give me a sense of that in your career, how that's changed?
Yeah, I mean, this is a truly amazing time to be a scientist. Artificial intelligence, or whatever you want to call machine learning, has transformed this field particularly. So we are going much faster than we could go before at describing, generating data sets, maps, if you will, It's a slightly different thing to say understanding them. I don't want to go there. I'm not sure we understand any of them, but we certainly can make these maps quicker.
And is that what excites you about the next stage of the work for you? Or what's the cutting edge for you around research? I know it's about mapping the brain of a mouse, but where are we going within this field? Just give me a sense of that.
I mean, I went to medical school and I was interested in brains and found that fields like psychiatry and neurology and neurosurgery were not obviously getting us right towards a clear understanding. So my initial motivation, I think, was always thinking about illness and whether this would be an approach for diagnosis at the very least, and maybe insight into the underlying causes of diseases. But once you're in a field which is so open-ended at the moment, we know much less than we should relative to the other organ systems. The brain is still quite a primitively understood organ, largely because of this enormous complexity and the fact that a lot of it is wired based on experience. So no two wiring diagrams is the same. There are all these confounds that make it hard to study. That I'm deeply sort of immersed now in just the meaning, just extracting some map with the hope that I'll get some kind of meaning out of it. And maybe it will be another generation of scientists once these map-making tools become quite routine, where the kind of systematic study of people with particular disabilities, cognitive disabilities, can be studied. You know, I'm old. I have to set my sights on what's still possible before I die. So I hate to be morbid about this, but, you know, I think, you know, the history of science works is that there are questions that are begun and take many generations of scientists to reach a satisfactory end. And the end is usually not the end of the subject. It's just that the paradigm at the end has shifted to a new way of looking. And I think right now we are in a paradigm shift in data as opposed to understanding, that we are generating data much more quickly than understanding it. Whereas most of my career was a lot about understanding the principles of the brain.
Right.
Without much data. So we were never sort of held back by data because we didn't have any. And now we have this enormous amount of data. We have these maps that are fantastic, but making sense of them is the calamity, is the casualty of big data, is understanding, if you will. We're having a hard time making sense of all this right now. But every once in a while, we see these regularities, like these very powerful connections and a bunch of other interesting things that give you hope that doing this is not a fool's errand, that we will learn something in the end that's worthwhile.
Well, sure. Like any map of the world is only provisional, right? So I'm always fascinated by this, you know, a map is always a selective representation of the place it depicts. It can't be anything else, because a one-to-one map of the world will be useless. That's always the joke that Lewis Carroll and Borges write stories about this. So when I was looking at your brain maps, I wondered a similar thing of how the map of the brain will always keep evolving and changing, and it will become more and more complex. But that is a kind of infinite process, I guess, which is why you talk about the description of it moves on and on. But that doesn't mean you don't discover things along the way, but it also doesn't mean that you'll come to an end and say, we've done it, we've cracked it. That's impossible. That's never, and that's a fool's errand.
Yeah, I really like this notion that a map is not the end. When it comes to the Earth, of course, the maps are changing because the Earth is changing.
As the brain is changing.
And every one of these maps is telling us something about a time. And with the brain, one of the challenges of these maps is that you only get one shot at a brain, these maps. I can't go back to the same brain because that piece of tissue is devitalized entirely in order to make this map. So I can't go back and look again. And that is a shame. That is a real shame, because it would be great to watch these maps emerge. I'd love to see a baby's map turn into an adult's map. And that's very hard to do.
Absolutely. What an incredible concept of making that move through time on space, because that's what a map does. A map captures, you know, spatially a moment in time. Jeff, it's been wonderful to look at this extraordinary map of the brain with you, and it's just a real privilege. And I think there's a lot of time and space for you to go with. I don't think it's over yet. So, Jeff Lipman, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map? It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Jerry. Great talking to you.
I am struck by how much of the brain and its functions are left to understand. Even after breakthroughs like Jeff's colour mapping techniques in decades of study, it shows how incredibly complex and intricate the brain is, a mystery that may never be solved in our lifetimes. I'm Jerry Broughton. Thank you so much for listening. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Jill Achineku from Whistledown. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the collection, see the maps from this podcast, and send suggestions for future maps at oculi-mundi.com.